from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The Canadian police have released a video showing the man who went on a shooting spree inside Canada's parliament. Police identified the attacker as Michael Zehoff Bibeau, a 32-year-old Quebec-born male who, according to media reports, was a recent convert to Islam that police say was planning to go to Syria. Authorities have concluded that he acted alone. We have this report from Press TV.
Canadian police have released a video showing the person who went on a shooting rampage inside the Parliament building. They've also identified the attacker, saying he was planning to go to Syria.
The suspect has been identified as Michael Joseph Zehoff Bibeau, 32 years old. He is a Canadian citizen, and we have information that he may have had dual Libyan-Canadian citizenship. This individual has been in Ottawa since at least October 2nd, 2014. He was in town to deal with a passport issue, but that he was also hoping to leave for Syria.
Police say Zehoff Bibeau acted alone as he killed a soldier at the National War Memorial and then stormed Parliament in Ottawa. They say there isn't any link between this rampage and an earlier killing of another soldier in Quebec. Western countries have been on alert to crack down on homegrown radicals who plan to join extremist groups, including ISIL in Syria. The Canadian Prime Minister has pledged to beef up measures against what he said are terrorist attacks in the country.
Brazil's incumbent president, Dilma Rousseff, is gaining in the polls and has apparently gained the support of a clear majority of those likely to vote in this Sunday's runoff election. We have this report from Press TV.
Just ahead of Sunday's presidential election runoff in Brazil's polls show incumbent Dilma Rousseff is gaining ground over her arch-rival Aécio Neves. The latest opinion polls put Rousseff at a clear lead of between 6 to 8 percentage points over Neves. Leftist Rousseff is the standard bearer for the ruling Workers' Party, while Neves is from a famous political family, and the business community favors him to end the economic recession gripping the country. The Sao Paulo stock market fell more than 3% after the poll's estimates were released.
Call for an end to protests in Hong Kong by one of the city's former leaders. Hong Kong's former chief executive, Tung Chi Hwa, said the Occupy Central protest is tearing the community apart and severely affecting the city's economy. We have this report from the Chinese news agency, CCTV.
If Occupy Central continues, the damage to Hong Kong's future is hard to imagine. For the whole country, Occupy Central has also damaged relations between Hong Kong and the mainland. No matter today or tomorrow, a prosperous Hong Kong cannot be built without the backing of the strong nation. In 1997, Hong Kong's GDP was 60% of the whole nation. Today, it is 3%. So it is very urgent to rebuild mutual confidence between Hong Kong and the mainland. It is our responsibility. Meanwhile, Occupy Central has also torn Hong Kong society apart. The longer the illegal protest continues, the longer society will be damaged. Indeed, a successful democracy needs mutual respect, rule of law, tolerance, and compromise. And it means different voices need to be heard. A successful democracy means more effort to reunite Hong Kong in future. I am worried that Occupy's actions will turn bad as more illegal people join. The so-called peaceful occupation does not exist anymore. It is severely damaging Hong Kong's citizens' lives. The whole region's economy, society, order, and investors' confidence all have been affected. Work opportunities have decreased. This isn't just ordinary news on the radio or in a newspaper. It is really damaging people's lives.
During the press conference, Tung Chi Hwa also pointed out that election for Hong Kong's chief executive in 2017 is an authentic and valid democratic election.
If we host an election in 2017, every candidate will have to win the support of the election committee and the voters by his policy proposals. Please imagine how can such a chief executive, elected by 5 million Hong Kong voters, not base his policies on public opinion? The election in 2017 is not an end, but rather a starting point. Relevant mechanisms in the basic law manage to keep democracy progressing in Hong Kong. The 2017 election is an authentic democratic one in terms of its progress as well as its end result.
Tung Chee Hwa also called on Occupy Central protesters to call off their demonstration.
I want to say this to the Occupy Central protesters. I hear your voice. I feel what you feel. Your concerns are shared by the Hong Kong SAR government as well as the central government. But I think we need to find a more rational and practical solution. What you're proposing is a deviation from the basic law in the decision of the MPC Standing Committee and therefore cannot be achieved. Many democratic countries in the West do not have a system for civil nominations. The students' insistence on civil nominations as a prerequisite for democracy is a misunderstanding. I hope you can make the comparison yourselves. It is my belief that the level of democracy reflected in our nomination process is more advanced than that of many places elsewhere.
And if the protesters had any doubts before about the Chinese national government's resolve in the matter, a statement issued Friday by Hua Chunying, a spokesperson for the foreign ministry, removed them.
Since the handover, the basic rights of Hong Kong residents have been fully protected by the basic law. The central government firmly supports Hong Kong's gradual development of a democratic political system in line with the characteristics of the region. The decision of the National People's Congress Standing Committee on August the 31st was made after listening to opinions of all sectors of the Hong Kong community. It conforms with Hong Kong's basic law and the characteristics of the region. Therefore, it serves as constitutional basis for Hong Kong's universal suffrage. Its legal status and effect are unshakable.
It ain't much, or so it appears to a world racked by war, poverty, disease, and gross inequality, but it is, at the moment, all we've got. That was essentially the message from the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon Friday as he marked the 69th anniversary of the founding of the United Nations.
At this time of multiple crises, the United Nations is needed more than ever. Poverty, disease, terrorism, discrimination, and climate change are exacting a heavy toll. Millions of people suffer from exploitative and unsafe working conditions. The global economy remains an uneven playing field. The United Nations was founded to end such assault on human dignity and lead the way to a better future. There have been painful setbacks, and there is much work ahead. But we can take heart from our achievements in advancing peace, human rights, and human dignity. The UN Millennium Development Goals have inspired the most successful anti-poverty campaign ever. As we strive to finish the job, we are also shaping a sustainable development agenda and seeking a meaningful climate change agreement all by 2015. The United Nations is also mobilized against the Ebola outbreak, a huge and global challenge that demands a huge and global response. On this United Nations Day, let us reaffirm our commitment to the marginalized and vulnerable and work in common cause for the common good.
The UN officially came into existence on October 24th of 1945 upon the ratification of its charter by China, France, the Soviet Union, the UK, the US, and a majority of the other signatories. United Nations Day is celebrated on October 24th each year. Friday also marked the 44th anniversary of the day that Salvador Allende was officially declared the winner of the Chilean presidential election, making him at that time the first elected socialist president in the Western Hemisphere since Guatemala's socialist president, Jacobo Arbenz Guzman, was deposed in a coup organized by the CIA in 1954. Because Allende had won a plurality and not an absolute majority of the popular vote, the Chilean National Congress had to select a president from the two front runners, Allende and Jorge Alessandri, who was nominally an independent candidate, but ran with the support of the National Party and the rest of the Chilean right. Allende's share of the popular vote was about 37% to Alessandri's 35%, in third place at 28%, and out of the running under Chile's constitution was Radomiro Tomic, the presidential candidate for the Christian Democratic Party, who also campaigned using a clearly leftist tone. The Christian Democrats pledged to endorse Allende in the congressional vote, thereby assuring him the presidency. But the U.S. was not prepared to allow Allende to take office. Edward Corey was the U.S. ambassador to Chile for the Nixon administration at the time. This is an excerpt of an interview he gave, taken from a French documentary entitled simply, Salvador Allende.
What was Nixon's reaction to Allende's election?
Well, I was not there, but I can tell you what we now know to be a fact. He ordered the CIA to prevent Allende from assuming the presidency.
And how?
He's how he ordered him, I'm not sure. He just said he did not wish Allende to go from being president-elect to being the actual president, that is, to be inaugurated. And he told the CIA to do it whatever way it could.
Did it include a military coup?
Oh, it certainly included a military coup, and indeed they tried to get me to lean on the Chilean military right after Allende was elected. And what happened was three of the top generals met with our military attaché, called him in, and said, what would the United States like us to do? In effect, asking us to support a coup.
They did not waste time. The day before Allende's election was to be ratified, a group attempted to kidnap General René Schneider Giraud, commander-in-chief of the army, hoping to use the crisis to provoke an intervention by the military that would place the armed forces, instead of Allende, in control of Chile. The effort instead had the opposite effect, and Allende was inaugurated on November 3rd, 1970. It was less than 3 years and several more coup attempts later that the U.S. got its way when General Augusto Pinochet led a military coup that included bombing the presidential palace and led ultimately to the death of Allende on September 11th, 1973.
Viva Chile! Viva el pueblo! Viva los trabajadores!
Pinochet installed a right-wing dictatorship that persisted until the 1990s, and it wasn't until 1998, almost three decades after Allende's election, that another socialist was elected president in South America, that being Venezuela's Hugo Chavez, who himself survived a coup attempt in April 2002 that was planned, financed, and made operational by the U.S. Since Chavez was first elected, socialism has made broad gains throughout Latin America. Chavez himself was elected twice more and enjoyed enormous popularity. Likewise, Bolivia's Evo Morales, Nicaragua's Daniel Ortega, and Ecuador's Rafael Correa have led a coalition of leftist governments that is now the center of political, social, and economic gravity in the region that has seen socialist Cuba move from the role of regional pariah to elder brother. Leftist governments have also taken hold, albeit to a lesser degree, in Argentina, Brazil, Chile, El Salvador, and Uruguay. Honduras elected a leftist president in 2006, but he was deposed by a U.S.-backed coup in 2009. This weekend, two of those countries, Brazil and Uruguay, are holding the final rounds of presidential elections, and here to discuss that and the ongoing case of the missing student teachers in Mexico is our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo.
Just to refresh people's memory, what seems to have happened, what's been quite well established now since the original events of 26th, 27th of September, is that in the Mexican state of Guerrero, in a town called Iguala, which is quite a large town outside the regional capital, the state capital there, two or three buses full of trainees student teachers were stopped by police and subsequently fired on. And in that incident, six people were killed, 17 were wounded. I'm just looking at the figures here on the web in a report by Telesur, and a total of 58 students, in fact, were disappeared, of which 15 have subsequently been found, and one of them dead. So there's so far there's a total of seven students dead.
And 14 witnesses,
43
right?
43 disappeared.
And 14 witnesses, right?
Yeah, that's right. And I'm a leading human rights activist, a veteran priest who's won prizes in Mexico for his human rights work, says that according to his sources, and he's spoken to both police officials who've been detained by the authorities in relation to that event, and he's also talked to survivors. He says that the balance of opinion is that the students were killed. It's a very strange story, in fact. And if you kind of dig around it, what seems to have happened is it seems to have been something of a grudge, because the governor of the mayor of Iguala, a guy called Jose Luis Abarca, he actually ordered the police to intercept the buses because they were on the way to protest at an official function that was going to be presided over by the mayor's wife, in fact. And this pair, the mayor and his wife, had apparently had a run-in the year previously with the students who were in a similar kind of protest. And they seem to have taken the decision to order the police to intercept the buses, and from that point it seemed to have got out of hand, and currently the mayor and his wife are on the run. They seem to have disappeared and the authorities are looking for them. It's an extraordinary story.
It is, really.
And what seems to have happened, the authorities, the federal authorities, are apparently working with the state prosecutor in Guerrero. And they seem to have pieced together a story that runs along the following lines, that the mayor and his colleagues were on the payroll in some shape or form of a group of drugs traffickers called Guerreros Unidos, a group of organized crime, not just not drugs trafficking, but organized crime in general.
Right.
And they seem to have completely taken over the municipal institutions in Iguala, and also in a neighboring state, a neighboring town.
Well, one thing though, the mafia won't have to pay any rent or upkeep on a city hall anymore.
Well, right, and what seems to have happened is that the students were detained, and the authorities have the last known whereabouts of the students was that they were taken from the Iguala prison to a police station in the neighboring municipality of a place called Cocula, which is also controlled by this organized crime group called Guerreros Unidos. And the students were taken to a zone called Pueblo Viejo near Cocula and handed over to Guerreros Unidos members, gang members, and that's the last that's known of them. So, you know, and that's a terrible story for people in Mexico to have to assimilate, and a terrible event for both for the students concerned, for their families. But I'm trying to look at it in a broader sense, and it's just a terrible condemnation of Mexico's political institutions and the infiltration of organized crime into its society.
Yeah. It is. It sounds like a mafia state there, basically. That is bizarre.
Guerrero. There's no doubt at all that Guerrero as a state. Sorry to interrupt.
It's okay.
But what's happened in Guerrero is that the actual governor of the state has resigned,
yeah.
And he's kind of acknowledged that technically he's just taken 30 days leave, but essentially what he's done is resigned,
yeah.
And he's handed over his authority and powers to his legally constituted deputy, who's the Secretary of the State, and in 30 days the state National Assembly will decide where to go from there. But perhaps it's worth pointing out that Mexico is a federal state and similar to the United States.
Right.
And that each state has its own authorities.
Right.
Looking at it from the outside, and Mexico in many ways is the kind of failed neoliberal state that you can see the United States policy trying to set up around the world.
Right. Yeah, it's like one of the early models, I think.
Yeah, and because if you look at United States foreign policy, it seems geared to destroy countries and destroy societies and create chaotic political and economic conditions in that make the what's left of the economy of a country ripe for corporate predators to pick over. And I don't think we're being paranoid at all or extremist in making that suggestion, because if you look at what's happened, what's the biggest economic event in Mexico over the last 6 months? The privatization of Mexico's oil resources.
That's right.
And what was that about? That's about opening up Mexico's natural resources to foreign corporations.
I interviewed Fernando Velasquez, who produces a Spanish language news cast up here in the U.S., Informativa Pacifica. And he is Mexican by birth. He grew up there, and he is very involved in what's going on down there, too. But he knows Mexico intimately, being the relevant point. And he said to me, he described that the oil, the whole oil deal that was just done, that's in the process of being implemented but has already been passed and approved, is in the very same Guerrero, a lot of the oil, and a lot of the oil workers who would be in opposition to the privatization of oil.
There's that, and there's also the longer term effects of the North American Free Trade Agreement, which people in the United States are now themselves experiencing in quite an extreme form.
That's right.
But in Mexico, what's happened over the last decade, and when was NAFTA introduced? On 1994 under Clinton.
Yep.
So then, and what's happened since 1994 in Mexico is that what gave Mexico's society stability was its deep rural roots. And what NAFTA has done is NAFTA's destroyed that. It's destroyed the agricultural economy for small and medium farmers in Mexico.
Mm-hmm. Like it's done all over the world, actually. Africa, yeah. Too.
So, what's happening, if one wants to take a cold view of the terrible events in Iguala, and it's a kind of, it's a symptom of the broader breakdown of Mexican society and Mexico's native economy, Mexico's indigenous economy, and its sovereign control of natural resources. You can see the same kind of process happening in Guatemala, which is Mexico's southern neighbor, of course. You can see it happening in Honduras. And the countries that are resisting it, Nicaragua, and now that El Salvador has a progressive government under the FMLN, led by President Salvador Sanchez Serén. And we'll see increasing resistance to the pernicious effects of the neoliberal ideological model in El Salvador. And we're likely to see some resistance still in Costa Rica, because under Laura Chinchilla, the former Costa Rican president, and Costa Rica was heading down the same path as Honduras and Guatemala. And Laura Chinchilla herself acknowledged that the Costa Rican authorities were losing control losing control in terms of their attempts to block the encroachment into Costa Rican society and into Costa Rica's economy of organized crime. And she acknowledged that before she lost power in the last Costa Rican election. So, you know, and what people see in Mexico is, it's certainly from the point of view of people here in Nicaragua, and they see it as a kind of warning of what might happen to this country or any Latin American country.
Or to Brazil, for example, looking at elections, the final election on Sunday, that might be one of the two choices in front of the Brazilian people.
Yeah, I'm looking at that, and that it looks as though the election scenario, if you like, to use that horrible word, has been kind of set back. It's kind of been reset to where it was about 2 months ago, 3 months ago, before the death of the Brazilian Socialist Party candidate Eduardo Campos. And back then, it was a two-horse race between Dilma Rousseff and Aécio Neves, the social democrat, the right-wing social democrat candidate. There was this dreadful incident in which Eduardo Campos, who was then running third, died. His party then turned to Marina Silva, who dramatically came to the fore, displacing Aécio Neves and receiving substantial support from the Brazilian oligarchy as their preferred candidate. And then as she failed, because she was a lamentable candidate, her performance was dreadful, as she failed, the oligarchy switched their support to Aécio Neves. And now we're back to a two-horse race between Neves and Rousseff, with pretty much similar figures to the figures that, in the opinion polls, that were being held about 2 or 3 months ago. Now, in the last couple of days before the election, Dilma Rousseff has, 54%?
Yeah, 54-46 on the latest, and one immediately before that, 53-47. So it looks like she's going to squeak it out.
It looks like she, and let's hope so, because if she doesn't, it'll be a grim time for all the efforts of the progressive governments trying to promote Latin American integration.
The poll shows that her lead is great. I'm sorry to interrupt. Her lead is greater than the margin of error at plus or minus 2%. She's got either three, plus or minus 3 or plus or minus 4, so that's significant. And
that's the second round. So assuming that she wins, then that's it. She'll be the president. But whereas in Uruguay, and on the 26th, people in Uruguay are going to vote, and it'll be the first round. It looks as though Tabaré Vázquez, the candidate of the ruling Frente Amplio party, will win, but with not enough to get 50% of the vote on the first round. They have a very similar electoral system to the system in Brazil, so that means that Tabaré Vázquez and the other candidate will go to a second round, which Tabaré Vázquez will certainly win. And there seems very little doubt. It'll be a real turn-up if Tabaré Vázquez doesn't win on Sunday. And that's in, of course, that's in quite some contrast to the situation in Brazil, where we're all kind of hoping and praying that Dilma pulls it off.
Yeah, definitely. A lot of that going on right here in this chair, as a matter of fact. And then can't let the day go by without noting that 44 years ago today, Salvador Allende was elected as president of Chile, which led to all of that mess subsequent.
Yeah, and another sad anniversary, right? And it's just that just reminds us of the way U.S. influence has shaped Latin America over the last 50 years, going on for 50 years now. And over 45 years, and the corresponding importance of efforts by leaders like Fidel, Hugo Chavez, Nicolas Maduro, his successor, Rafael Correa, by the way, was in Switzerland over the last couple of days and made a speech in which he appealed to President Obama to leave Latin America in peace.
Yeah.
You've got all these progressive leaders trying to do their best for their people and openly saying that they wish the United States would leave Latin America alone.
And that's all the news we have for you right now.
For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.